I'm Steve Lascalzo, and this is The Way. Welcome to This is The Way podcast's reaction and discussion episode for Chapter 19 of The Mandalorian. Season 3, Episode 3, the title is The Convert. Who is The Convert? Is it Bo-Katan? Is it Penn Pershing? Is it Alaya Kane? Well, if you're not caught up through the Ides of March, stop. Part of the joy of this latest episode for me was that it brought back the experience I had watching the first season. Back then, I was interpreting everything I was seeing on the screen as leading me toward what I thought would be the conclusions. Then things took a turn and went somewhere else. I've been covering Star Wars since before The Mandalorian debut on Disney Plus. And in the past few months, we've had the excellence of Andor, and now Mando Season 3 is humming along. Star Wars of late has been very, very good.
This is the way.
This is the way.
This is the way.
March 15th, 2023, Season 3, Episode 3, Chapter 19, The Convert on Disney Plus. And look, I was wrong. I thought there's no way we're picking back up on Mandalore after seeing the Mythosaur, but we did. Now, I don't think we should have. I think we should have gone straight to Coruscant, but we get confirmation in this episode of character names, establishing days of the week in canon, the differences and similarities between the Children of the Watch and the Empire, yellow biscuits, red herrings. I mean, we also find out that despite what we're being told, there might just be something magical about those living waters after all.
He speaks the truth. These are indeed the living waters.
The thumbnail description and full episode description on Disney Plus are the same and read on Coruscant, former Imperials find amnesty in the New Republic. The runtime for episode 3, chapter 19? It shows up as 59 minutes in parentheses on the Disney Plus show page. This is a long episode. If you press play, you're going to get to the credits in a little over 53 minutes. 53 minutes, 11 seconds. If you skip the previously on and go to the aftermath of Bo fishing out Din from the living waters, you can get through the episode in about 51 and 3/4 minutes. Was there anything for us to learn from the concept art during the credits in this show, though? I spotted a hut on the red carpet of the Opera House during Omid Abdahi and M. O'Brien's listings in the credit. The psychology or therapist droid appeared different. It was more independent in the concept art. It had its own legs and stuff. It was certainly shinier. And, you know, I think it was bolted to the floor in the episode. The train and the shipyard conditions looked different as well. And so did the Imperial Destroyer Lab. It's not a big deal when they look different, but I do feel like we can learn something. Like, the instruction to the artist is closer to the original intention, I think. And then set design comes in, and then there's a practicality of the shots that has to come into play. The way the scenes appear in the episode, that's canon. But I really do like to compare, and I think about the differences between the action and the concept art. I think it gives us some insight.
You think?
The credits start with the director, so that's where we're going to start too. Lee Isaac Chung, Oscar nominated for writing and directing Minari. I don't think it was his fault the episode started and ended with Din and Bo-Katan and Grogu, and then all the Pershing stuff was in the middle. I say fault. I don't mean that that was a problem or that it was awful. I just think the only thoughtful criticisms I've seen about the episode concern this sandwiching of Coruscant in between the visits to the Mandalorians. I don't know if it could have been put together in a better way. Cutting between them might have been even more awkward. Maybe that's how it was written, but I just feel like they should have just delayed the Mandalorian stuff to the next episode. But then you probably get people complaining about, you know, where's Mando in his own show? I think that's a silly criticism, but I do think it was out there, especially considering what happened in the Book of Boba Fett when they went away from Boba Fett and showed the Mandalorian. So maybe it was the writer. Writing credit going to Jon Favreau, but we do get confirmation in this credits that he shared co-writing with at least one other person this season. Maybe later this season with another. I said earlier in the season that we'd have to wait and see if he was sole credit throughout. This latest episode confirms he does share the spotlight. Noah Clore is his co-writer on this one. He was a staff writer on The Book of Boba Fett and has been listed as an assistant on several other episodes of The Mandalorian, including this season. This time, he gets a co-credit. And he was actually listed before Favreau, so that might be an actual honor for him. Director of photography is Dean Cundey, returning after handing over the job last week to someone else. I mentioned it before, he's a legend. He's worked on Back to the Future series, the Halloween movies, Jurassic Park, and many more. And in this episode, he actually got to take a turn in front of the camera as well. He performs as the magician in Monument Plaza. I don't go through all of the crew, but I do have one more to mention because, like Cundey, he gets to step from production into the acting realm. Dylan Fershine has edited the majority of episodes for The Mandalorian, and in this one, he got to voice the taxi droid. I do like it when people working hard behind the scenes get to step into a different role. Maybe that's their reward. Speaking of the credited cast,
nobody here gives their real name.
Pedro Pascal is the Mandalorian, but Brendan Wayne and Lateef Crowder seem to have earned their permanent place in the co-starring list, and they appear over the concept art for a third straight episode, and maybe for the whole season. Bo-Katan Kryze is played by Katie Sackhoff, and she's been quite chatty lately, hasn't she? The insight on Twitter and Instagram and YouTube, it's welcome. But she does seem to be indicating character motivations and maybe some creative directions to her that I haven't expected. If you're wondering what I'm talking about, you can find plenty of interviews with her lately if you're not sure what I'm talking about. Omid Abtahi knocks it out of the park with his Carol Burnett ear-pulling performance of Dr. Penn Pershing. His character is someone I think figures heavily in the plot of the sequel trilogy of movies, even though we don't hear of him there, and actually we never heard of him until The Mandalorian's debut. The background he gives about himself certainly has fit with his portrayal since that first episode, so he's very consistent as a character. Katie M. O'Brien is another standout. She took what could have been a small part. You know, no actors, no small parts, just small actors. Well, she had a part in the second season as one of Moff Gideon's communications officers. She parlayed it into a return for the character of Aliyah Kane, Officer G-68, I think. I saw she was also in the recent Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, as Gentora. Also, she was in three episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Kimball, you interested in a promotion?
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know how I like to list those people, even though it wasn't like my favorite show or anything. I just always love those connections. There were four actors listed as aristocrats in that post-TED Talk scene with Pershing. Number one was Valerie Pettiford, and she appeared in one episode each of The West Wing and The X-Files. Many more, but those are the ones I noticed. Number two, the one who can't tell the Republic from the Empire or the New Republic, that was Stephen Kieran. Done a ton of voice work for TV, movies, and is a video game voice for the Sims series of games. And if you played those games, you know the nonsense words, like he's one of those voices. Number three was Norwood Cheek. Does some directing. I think I found out how he got the acting gig here, though. He's a friend of Peyton Reed, who directed for The Mandalorian last season, as well as the Ant-Man series of movies for Marvel. That's Peyton Reed, not Norwood Cheek, the actor. Peyton Reed, though, probably got him the job. I mean, it helps to have friends like that, right? And I think Cheek may have been the Mon Cala in that group of aristocrats. Number four, Vianne Cox. I recognize her from You've Got Mail. She was the lady who was upset that the bookstore might close. And also, she's Toby from Pendant Publishing on Seinfeld. You know, the one who loses a toe and then Kramer finds it?
Well, it's a valuable appendage.
There are three amnesty officers listed. M40 is Matthew Bellows. He's been grinding out a living in Hollywood, but he does have a connection to Disney as having been a Kree accuser in Captain Marvel. G27 is James Chen. Lots of work on cop dramas and a Marvel connection with work on The Amazing Spider-Man as a police officer and a role on Iron Fist as Sam. M34 was Max Fowler. The lab tech was Danny Jacobs, and he's done voice work for Lego Star Wars projects and a lot of other shows and games. The parole droid was voiced by Regina Hermosillo out of the art department. She gets her first voice acting work after a season's worth of work coordinating the sets for The Mandalorian, and she's worked on The Good Place, American Crime Story, This Is Us, Happy Endings, and Castle, to name a few. Speaking of Castle, Sunkrish Bala played Vikram Singh on that show, Castle, and he is the Amnesty Affairs Commissioner in this episode. The guy that tells Alia Kane she's a success story. And Tate Fletcher is once again in the suit as Paz Vizsla, even though I'm pretty sure Jon Favreau is still voicing the character. One more note. Last episode, I mentioned the Rodian customer was played by Don Dinninger, who works in costuming and all these other aspects of the production. She was fond of playing Rodians, I think, because she was also the Rodian mom in the Book of Boba Fett. That episode, the Rodian had a little girl played by Arden Breyer-Voyles, and she was back playing a Rodian little girl in this episode. I was wondering where it was. Well, she was a spectator of the magician played by Dean Cundey. I don't know if that means it's the same little Rodian girl, because I didn't see Don Dinninger credited here, but there was a mother or another Rodian. So if this is the same one Din Djarin saw on the transport, I think if they use the same little girl in the suit, right? That may be their intention. So how about that? The Rodian mother and daughter are getting around the universe. Okay, so when you press play, the previously on segment starts, and we see the client talking about Dr. Pershing. The line picked.
This is Dr. Pershing. His enthusiasm outweighs his discretion.
Well, if you've already seen the episode, that line is very appropriate, I think. Curiously, Katie M. O'Brien's character is seen next, and she was listed in Chapter 14 only as comms officer. Now, she gets a name and probably some side gigs at conventions signing autographs for the rest of her life. She did have speaking parts already in those Season 2 episodes, but now she's back. She was apparently captured by the New Republic, and wow, does she deliver. Not only was I fooled by her performance, I'm still not sure what I saw. Next in Previously On was Din Djarin, again reminding us his trip last episode means he is redeemed. Then Bo-Katan says there's nothing magic about the minds of Mandalore, but I disagree there, Miss Kreese. I think there's something special, and maybe it's not magic or the Force or anything, but there's something to that water, isn't there? We see the entrance to the Chamber of the Living Water, see the plaque, hear her reading it, see Din reciting the creed, see him disappear, Bo-Katan saves him, she sees the Mythosaur, pulls him out of the water. Then we get to the Lucasfilm Limited slate and Star Wars lights and helmet sequence. Then we are right back in the mines, moments after the action stopped in the last episode, in fact, and I admit, I was a little disappointed, but that's probably because I was wrong, because I thought, no, we're not going to pick back up there, we're going to go to, you know, one of the core worlds and see a little bit of the Imperial officers or see Carson Teva or something. Well, I was wrong. Not completely, right? We do go there, but I said there's no way we pick back up in the mines. Well, the big takeaway for me out of this scene was that either Bo-Katan wasn't sure she really saw what she saw and has been thinking about it while Din Djarin was unconscious, or maybe she wants to figure out if she can use this information at the right time rather than having it spoiled by someone else knowing that. I think it's the former, and I think the actress indicated as much in an interview. I can't find it, but I'm pretty sure that she was just surprised and she's not sure how to reconcile her previous feelings. You know, everything she's known since she was a little girl has been a myth. Now it turns out it might actually have been true. If there is a prophecy about the beasts returning and Mandalore becoming great once more, does this finally mean for her that things are going to go her way? She would never have come to a realization like that had she not humored Din Djarin and this quest for redemption? That must be running through her mind.
I witnessed it. You bathed in the living waters. You are Mandalorian again. Can we leave now?
We cut from the mines back to the ship, so no more danger from the Alamites or the floating eye mech beast in this episode. I was thinking about the biblical connection again after last week's episode, and Alamites certainly sounds like an Israelite enemy, not too far off from sounding like the Amorites tribe, right? Like Babylonians, Hammurabi, somewhere in the area of Syria today. We may not hear much more about these creatures, and who knows if or when there's going to be a return to Mandalore, and where would they figure into the action, but it's just something I thought about. On the way back to Kalevala, Bo-Katan is warming up to Din Djarin. Just an episode after confronting his ship and saying, "I thought I told you to leave me alone."
"Bring me to my ship and I'll be on my way. You will forever have my gratitude."
"I would invite you in for a feast, but I'm guessing that helmet isn't coming off again."
"This is the way."
"This is the way."
I mean, inviting him in for a bite to eat here? This is an intimate offer in any culture, at least on the planet Earth. But it also does point out to me what exactly that vow for the Children of the Watch means, because it's hard to eat as a group with helmets on. That means it's probably not a customary thing for this sect. That takes away a crucial part of bonding, familial bonding. Eating together is a bonding experience. If you have to replace that, it's got to be with another custom that doesn't require showing your face or showing that same kind of vulnerability. Maybe that is one of the obstacles to, you know, why are the clans having so much trouble getting along? Maybe it's because they don't do simple things like that. Also, I played the audio there of Bo-Katan and Din Djarin saying, "This is the way." Did you catch Grogu?
"This is the way.
This is the way."
At first, I thought he was trying to warn them about the imminent attack from the TIE interceptors. You know, he was sensing it through the Force or something. But the puppet, when you watch it, is moving much less like that. And it looks like he's just repeating, "This is the way." Like his daddy and future mommy? I mean, the closed captioning simply says Grogu babbling, but it would have been awesome if they had captioned it, "This is the way," for his first actual words. Bottom line here, they're under attack, though. Mando has to help out on the guns until they get close to her castle. I mean, it's always fun to see someone man the guns in Star Wars, or at least for me, it's something like it calls back to New Hope with Han and Luke.
"I got him! Great kid! Don't get cocky!"
And by the way, I noticed that in the cockpit here, Grogu seals himself away from danger in that floating pram of his. In the season opener during the gun battle with the pirates on Navarro, he didn't shy away from trouble. He kept it open. But here, he's not piloting. He doesn't have a lot of control over his fate, so maybe that's the difference in why he closes it. The ship enters the atmosphere. Bo-Katan does a flyby of her castle. Mando drops out of the ship above the landing pad where his N1 is still parked. He just misses getting clipped by the interceptors giving chase of the gauntlet. I didn't catch just how close he came from dying on the first watch that I had, but he barely makes it to the ship. And a straggling TIE blasts the launch pad, but the N1 takes off in time. I really like the way this played out. Yeah, I know. None of this is real. But to me, it looked like it made sense, and that's all I need to keep up my suspension of disbelief. I'm also not one of those who minds callbacks to, like, the Razor Crest's maneuver above Navarro from Chapter 12, The Siege. I liked it. That's his piloting move. It worked before, probably a few times for him, so yeah, it's a go-to move. I feel similarly about the move Bo-Katan pulls in the gauntlet. It looks cool. You know, the drop, turn, and firing. There were enough extra details like the zero gravity on the drop and her mention of flying the cliffs as a kid. It all makes it believable enough to me. I can't stress enough how poorly some of the other Star Wars shows on Disney Plus have done that. It doesn't take much to keep me on board. But it is so noticeable when it's done wrong. Anyway, TIE bombers hit Bo-Katan's castle. And I don't know if that was part of the plan all along, like they drew her away. I mean, they were trying to shoot her down. So I think maybe they just assumed the interceptors would finish her off. There'd be no issues, but great timing on the enemy's part being away from her castle, right?
Nice shooting.
Hang on. I'm seeing something on the scope.
No. Those mudscuffers bombed my home.
She's understandably mad. But she's not inconsolable or out of control. She pursues and destroys one of the TIE bombers, but Din Djarin is able to reason with her and the reinforcements that are coming in. She follows him to escape to lightspeed. I thought maybe they were heading to Coruscant to report this. I knew we were going to end up there from the description. I don't know what they would have done, but that's kind of where I thought things were going. But look, the space and air battles have been excellent so far, in my opinion. They don't have to reinvent the wheel for me every episode or show me something I've never seen every single time, but it's Star Wars, and I like having a little air and space show now and then to remind me about, you know, the wars among the stars. In Andor, there wasn't a lot of that. It was still a great show, but, you know, think about it. When Luthen busts out those moves against the Cantwell-class Arrestor Cruiser above Segre Milo, it was a real big highlight. I mean, that got a lot of people talking. Here in The Mandalorian, we're getting to see it more often, in fewer episodes, or at least we have so far. It's not getting old or stale, not to me.
That's a lot of ships for an Imperial warlord.
I'm sending jump coordinates.
To where?
Someplace they won't find us.
They go to hyperspace and the title screen appears. We do not find out where Din and Bo and Grogu and R4 or R5-D4 have gone yet. The Convert is the title in the story. We're going to see now regards the amnesty of former Imperials and their new lives on Coruscant, so maybe that's the Convert, but who is this Convert? Does it refer to more than one person? I think so. Dr. Pershing is giving what's basically like a TED Talk in space in a place very familiar to Star Wars prequels fans. This is the same place Palpatine gave his Darth Plagueis the Wise speech to Anakin. That's not an accident. I think that's a hint to us that Pershing's work is absolutely going to tie into the sequel trilogy and the cloning of Snoke and Palpatine on Exegol.
Despite the shameful work of my past, I now hope to help the New Republic in whatever way I can. Though that work is now behind me and I regret what I did, I assure you that my original intentions were good.
Oh, you don't say. Your intentions were good. Well, that's a lame excuse, especially when scientists know that their intentions aren't why they're being afforded that help.
When I was young, I lost my mother, the person who I admired most. Her heart gave out. Had simple organ cloning been available on my home world, her death would have been easily preventable. It was then that I vowed to make it my life's work to help others avoid such needless loss. Thanks to the groundbreaking work of the Kaminoans, we know that cloning can duplicate an individual from a single genetic strand. What my work explored was the hopes of combining multiple strands to create replicas that incorporated the best genetic attributes of both donors.
Pershing goes to the tearjerker too, using his mom's death. Now, maybe that's sincere, but I don't know. He's got this ear pull. Is it a tell? Is it a sign he's lying? Or is he truly accessing his pain from his past? You know, I wonder if giving this talk is a condition or part of the rehabilitation process. Like, come see another Imperial, bend the knee. And then he gets to go and live in amnesty housing or something. I don't know. Moff Gideon's communications officer was watching in the audience. I don't blame you if you didn't recognize her immediately, but she was the one from last season that reported the tracker was in place that allowed Grogu's capture in the tragedy. And I mean, she was in the previously on, so if you're watching that, you probably followed along there. She doesn't track Pershing down immediately after the speech, though. Instead, Pershing runs into the liberals in the lobby, a bunch of aristocrats congratulating themselves at their tolerance and the amnesty of the former Imperials that probably helped them get richer. It's a solid reminder that the New Republic is going to fail against the First Order, and Leia's warnings are going to fall on deaf ears. Pershing is driven home by a taxi droid. He's alone, and he's going to his halfway house, I guess. I didn't see a lot of guards there. Pershing runs into some former officers drinking in the commons, and there's the comms officer.
This is G-27, M-40, G-68.
Doctor.
Everything all right?
I didn't expect to see anyone from Moff Gideon's ship here.
Rather than Gideon being famous, he's infamous, even around other Imperials.
What does that mean, infamous?
Oh, infamous is when you're more than famous.
Wow, the infamous? Infamous?
You see what I did there? It's a sweater.
Infamous?
It means murderous, evil, all like you said.
Okay, back to Star Wars. In this scene, the seeds of doubt are being planted. I'm already skeptical about the rehabilitation program. As the scene played on, I doubted the sincerity of the male officers Pershing met less. Pershing seemed to me to be embarrassed and uncomfortable because of his personal weakness. And I think that's based on the prior appearances of him in the series. That's what I'm basing it on. I was highly skeptical, however, and even more so as the scene played out, of comms officer G-68. First, we know she just went to the show, right? Now she's waiting here. She got there before him, but not with friends, because they didn't yet know she worked for Gideon, and we saw she didn't go with them. It's as if she rushed home to wait for him. Then, like Pershing was invited to join the drinking group, she got invited too. Her dialogue feels a little bit more forced, or it feels like she's trying to recite lines from Rehab or be convincing, which is not truthful.
I try not to think about him anymore. Thanks to the rehabilitation program, I can contribute to the New Republic. Just like you.
Just like all of us. Long live the New Republic.
Long live the New Republic.
Long live the New Republic.
A great job by Miss O'Brien. Great performance. And the score went from ominous when she was introduced to more hopeful and light by the toast. But I feel like this was a scene designed to make us question the effectiveness of the reintegration. There's a great moment where G-27 asks, "What do you miss most?" to Pershing. And I think Pershing wonders, is this a trick?
What do you miss, L-52?
Miss?
From before.
No, I'm glad that the Empire is...
Oh, not like that. Of course, good riddance. I mean, more like the everyday stuff, like the food. Nothing.
So, here he was on guard, but he kind of lets his guard down. And this is when he tells the group about the yellow travel biscuits, and G-68, I think, makes a mental note. But it also tells us he's not initially trusting of these other former Imperials. G-68 also surprises the group, telling them she preferred the red ones, but...
Gotta say, though, I like the red ones.
The lie detector test determined that was a lie.
We'll see that later, of course. We cut to Pershing in his amnesty housing apartment, and you'd assume, you know, maybe this would have been a different night, because there's no way it would be that easy for someone to get those cookies so quickly. But it is absolutely the same night. First, Pershing is listening to facts about Coruscant, and he just has been transferred, and G-68, she had to have connections to get these biscuits that quickly. She surely didn't just go on an adventure that evening and then come back from the shipyards. By the way, we hear from the tablet Pershing is using that Coruscant is considered an ecumenopolis, a city spanning the entire planet. That voice is an uncredited Shelby Young. She's the voice of Leia in Lego Star Wars Summer Vacation. And then the Skywalker Saga video game by Lego. And then she's also done a few voices for the Bad Batch. Great job. Pershing gets an Imperial crate full of his yellow biscuits at his doorstep. And at this point, he wasn't sure who dropped them off. But I do have the feeling that he has a suspicion of who might.
Good morning, L-52. Happy Bindu Day.
The office space he works at is much less rigid than the one we saw in Andor. Maybe a lot has changed in 20 years or so, but the place feels less formal. The fact that work is piling up doesn't seem like that would have been something acceptable in the days of the Empire. The data tapes come in many different looks, right, in Star Wars. It's clear we see ones that do look like the first and most famous data tape that we saw in Star Wars, the one from A New Hope that Leia puts into R2-D2, and then later again, we saw that one in Rogue One handed through the door. And so how did I know the biscuits got there the same night? Well, if you were listening, the supervisor told Pershing, "I saw your talk last night." I think that's the only reason he came over, because we see him get bumped into by a droid that's delivering tapes. So I think he was just coming by to chat with this quasi-celebrity in his cubicle group, I guess. Or maybe it's just a sign of the inefficiency of this new workforce. Bendu Day as well. That's a day of the week in Star Wars that comes from a magazine, Build the Millennium Falcon, released by DeAgostini Press in 2016. You would build the Falcon step by step, issue by issue, with parts either provided for you or you were shown how to design it, and there were factoids about the galaxy included in those magazines. You can find an ad for this on YouTube if you search for it. Well, one of those notes is now canon. It was where they were speaking of days of the week. It's a 5-day week, not 7 days. There is a Sunday, and I know that because it's called Prime Day after the sun at the heart of the Coruscant system. There's a Monday, or Moon Day, but it's called Syntax Day, and that's after Coruscant's primary moon, Syntax. Bendu Day is like a Friday, I suppose, but it's just the fifth day, and that comes after Zell Day. And Bendu here refers to the Bendu monks that lived on Coruscant in the ancient past. And just a little side note, the Imperial Crest, it's actually part of that group's numerology. The number 9 was big for them, I guess, and it has 8 spokes off a central 9th disc. The central disc was the number 9 there, compared to the 8 spokes, and it was a significant number to the order. But maybe, you know, this is referring to the monks, at least according to like Wikipedia and other sources, but I really would find it highly unlikely that the Bendu monks have nothing to do with the Bendu that we see in Rebels. I mean, it has to be related. It has to. Oh, and one more day of the week is going to be mentioned later in the episode, and when we get to it, I'll mention it there too.
Following orders blindly is how we got in trouble in the first place. Sometimes you have to trust your gut. The New Republic is trying their best, but they're struggling. Lots of capable people who want to help. You understand what I'm saying?
So G-68 makes good on her earlier promise to show Pershing around Coruscant. She takes him to Monument Plaza. It turns out she trained at the Academy on Coruscant, so she knows a little bit about the place. It's featured in the Clone Wars, this Monument Plaza. It was a meeting spot for Obi-Wan Kenobi and Satine Kryze. Yes, Bo-Katan's sister, so I think there's a connection there for us. We see the scene I mentioned earlier of Dean Cundey as the magician with the little Rodian girl looking on, among others. The plaza is also home to Umate, the highest ground in Coruscant. It's the only place you can see the surface from the Ecumenopolis. It's a cool detail. I mean, it's hard to believe, but it's a cool detail, and that last dialogue I played is what the scene is all about. They're having glowing ice pops or whatever. I don't know what they're eating. I didn't see a booth that had Oribesh that I could describe, but it's not ice cream, right? Because it's glowing. Here, Pershing is trying to convince G-68 and himself that his work as a scientist was not really evil. It was going to help people. He just admitted in a previous scene how awful Gideon was. So did he really think that all of this work was going to be shared by, you know, out of the goodness of Gideon's heart? No. This is G-68, though, testing how much L-52 Pershing is going to bend.
You want to touch it?
Are we allowed to?
Allowed? Live a little, Doc. It's not the Empire.
And just know that when she said, you want to touch it, how much it took for me to resist putting in a Michael Scott, that's what she said there. During the dialogue breaks, you can hear obvious elevator music version of, I think, the March of the Resistance from The Force Awakens. It's unmistakable. It's already been, I've already seen YouTube headlines or you know, titles with it on there. It's, I guess it's diegetic too. That means the music is not just something that we hear. It's being heard by the patrons in that plaza. Now, I doubt that the track is called March of the Resistance there. I mean, just because John Williams names it something or Star Wars names it something doesn't mean that's what it's called. But hey, maybe the Resistance actually did take the name from the song. No, they didn't. But, you know, it's interesting to think about.
Have you experienced any feelings of anger or resentment towards your coworkers?
No.
Have you experienced any feelings of anger or resentment towards the New Republic government or its representatives?
No.
Thank you for continuing.
Can I ask a question?
Proceed.
If I were to pursue my own research recreationally, would that be allowed?
According to your file, your previous research involved cloning and genetic engineering. That class of research is expressly prohibited by the Coruscant Accords, Section 13, Subparagraph 7. My apologies. Do you have any further questions?
I guess not.
The questions come from this droid like a lie detector test.
That was a lie.
Not Maury. There's no incentive for Pershing to answer yes, even if that was the truth. In fact, when he's told no, he figures, hey, I know better. From this scene, we see he finds G-68 to tell her, you know, I'm ready to disobey. He balks when she tells him, well, we're going to have to break the rules to do it. But that's exactly what he's doing. We just heard the droid tell him no. His fear, it seems, is not what I'm doing is wrong, it's will I get caught? That's not a good place to be. He doesn't want to get sent back to rehabilitation. Now, I don't know, was this rehabilitation center really torturely? You know, I don't know. G-68 tells him to sleep on it, but he came to her. She was the one that actually ends up talking him out of it by, you know, saying we're going to have to break the rules, but then she's giving him more rope to hang himself by. The next day he's at work. He sees Imperial equipment's being destroyed just for being Imperial. His reasoning to his supervisor is, hey, this equipment wasn't bad. It was just what it was being used for. So he's making the same argument about the equipment as he is about himself. I'm not bad. Just my work was being used for bad. The supervisor shuts him down.
If I can have access to the equipment, I'd be happy to demonstrate
how. Can I be honest with you? We are really behind here. Not only do we have the Imperial disposal yards to inventory, but we're still decommissioning the Alliance fleet. I'm sure you understand.
I just think I could be helpful if I could.
It would require authorization from the department. You could submit a C-1023 request, but I've never seen someone from the Amnesty program make one of those. I'd have to check if that's even possible.
It's fine. Forget I asked.
I'm sorry, L-52. I know it's not easy, but I assure you, this is truly helping the New Republic.
Hey man, that's policy. You gotta fill out your TPS reports. You know, get rid of anything Imperial. We're too backed up. That's how things fall through the cracks. That's why stuff goes missing. That's why, you know, people might go missing, like Moff Gideon. In the hurry to wipe away this memory of the Empire, the New Republic isn't being thorough. Instead of dealing with this ugly past, they're just trying to ignore it. And we know from The Force Awakens how well that turns out.
Have you experienced any feelings of anger or resentment towards the New Republic government or its representatives? Apologies if you didn't hear me. Have you experienced any feelings of anger or resentment?
No.
Thank you for continuing to
be... Our main objective is to help the Republic, right?
Correct.
And that supersedes everything else?
It does.
His very next session, we hear he's already worked out his excuse. The comms officer didn't even have to push hard.
The mobile lab station? Let's go get it.
Good. Tomorrow night?
Did you hear that low chant? I wonder where we've heard something like that before.
You wanted to see me, Chancellor?
Yes, Anakin, come closer. I have good news.
I can't believe that's an accident. Favreau, Filoni, and Femi, you are not sloppy. This is a clue. It's, you know, what we already figured out is indeed happening in front of us. The walk through the transit station also has a musical cue that sounded familiar to me.
It's gonna be fine. Remember why we're doing this.
It's not identical, but it does remind me of episode 6 on Endor.
Come on, sit down. I promise I won't hurt you. Now come here.
No.
All right. You want something to eat? That's right. Come on.
Gunda.
Keep it together, Doc.
You're better at this than I am.
Oh, you'll get the hang of it.
Then we get a little more of it when they board the train, and we hear another day of the week, Tong's Days, am I right? Sounds a lot like Wednesdays, am I right?
Thong's Days, am I right?
And that's because it's the middle of the 5-day week. Like Bendu Day, it's a reference to a native to Coruscant, this time a species of creature, and I think that it has ties to the Mandalorian culture as well.
Where are we going?
The disposal yards. You know, the inventory you're cataloging.
What?
Well, Imperial ships all have mobile lab stations, right?
They do, but they're Imperial.
Well, not anymore.
We don't see L-52 and G-68 talk about his work on screen, but I think it's a safe bet to assume that they have at some point. It's not what she says as much as how she presents it to him that set off an alarm in my head. She's playing this part of the devil on the shoulder, right? Make no mistake, he is a willing participant. Ticket checker droids enter the cab and they've skipped parole, so to speak. So they didn't buy a ticket to the disposal yards. They probably couldn't. They basically jumped the turnstile, or in this case, they held it open with a foot. Now, that system wasn't built by Imperials, right? That's for sure. It would have probably shut on their foot anyways, but it probably long predates them, might even date back to the Old Republic. I mean, they're on a train, right? I mean, there's other forms of transportation that seem much, you know, to make much more sense. The electric binders between the cars, it's a Star Warsy touch, as is when the droid controls the walkway by pushing buttons on its chest. But when they jump to the next car, this is not a subtle metaphor. This is why we're having this scene. You know, she's having him take little leaps of faith. Same with the leap from the train. I mean, now that actually felt like a tad too much. I mean, I get that they fall onto padding and it could have been set up by her and this could have been part of the plan all along. But I look, jumping from a fast moving train like that, it was just a little too much. It was a little too much for me, a little much for non-Jedi, I think.
I'm sorry I never introduced myself.
You don't have to apologize. That's not how things were back then.
No. Now it is. Eliah Kane, communications officer.
Dr. Penn Pershing, scientist.
Nice to meet you, Dr. Pershing.
They get into a destroyer, and we know now for sure that she's a liar. I mean, she knew exactly who he was. She didn't forget, either. He was part of the mission that she got captured on. That'd be burned into her brain. Remember the shuttle where Din Djarin and Cara Dune boarded it after Boba Fett rendered it inoperable in the chapter 16? I mean, she knew.
This is perfect. Only take what I need.
So I'll go into the scrap heap.
While I was collecting clips, I think I realized just how much they're hitting this home. Pershing's not rehabilitated. He wasn't just a good guy that was being used. I'll only take what I need. His priority isn't even science. He just wanted to be part of something big, and the Empire enabled him.
I remember the first time I was in a place like this. I couldn't believe I'd made it. My mother was a doctor in the town where I grew up. I would spend days in her office dreaming of a lab like this. But to actually be in one...
You always knew what you wanted to do.
As far back as I can remember. What about you? What did you want to be when you grew up?
I didn't really have a chance to think about it.
The conversation gets cut short, and I really want to know, was Eliah Kane taken as a young child? Now, I know the Jedi did that, but she's no Jedi for sure. The First Order does that later, but this is before that. Also, when Pershing asks that question of her, she steps back, and Kane's face is covered in darkness, and that was on purpose as well. Something dark happened to her in her past. And by the way, did you see the actress responded to my question on Twitter? She says she doesn't know what kind of trauma she experienced. But hey, in this moment, she's the bait and the hook. And she did a great job because I still don't know what her motivation is. She keeps Pershing in the ship, though, a little bit longer than he might have stayed. And then she leads him into trouble rather than away from it.
Raise your hands, L-52.
Just wait. Wait. No.
He is taken to some sort of police facility. I mean, there was a police helicopter and police men who arrested him, so it looks like he's in for some light torture. The score sounded a lot like Jabba's Palace to me.
Good morning, Doctor.
Listen, I can explain. I wasn't trying...
No need. Amnesty Officer G-68 has already submitted a report.
What?
So how about that? A third piece of the score that sounds like an homage to something else. Not the exact same music. I mean, I'm not making that claim, but it does seem like it was inspired by it.
What did she tell you?
We understand that the adjustment can be difficult.
No. I think there's been a mistake.
But
I wasn't
we're here to help you. Indoctrination by the Empire is challenging to overcome.
It is sad to see Pershing so helpless, even though we've seen that it wasn't all someone else's fault. But I don't know anyone who wouldn't have laughed at his line to the Mon Cala supervisor.
This will only take a moment. I'll be here when you wake up.
You don't understand. She brought me there. It was a trap. Please, I just wanted to help. She set me up. Please. You set me up.
I mean, that wasn't just a wink and a nod. That was like, you know, on display for everyone to hear. He tries to explain his case, but the why did you set me up, that line, that affected me the most, I think. Like, why did you set me up? Why did you do this? He feels like it was all her, but we have seen the whole episode how little she had to actually try. Kane stays during the procedure. She asks to stay, and she's granted that trust by the supervisor, but this 602 mitigator looks to Pershing like a mind flayer. And we've heard how horrible that mind flayer torture was. To me, I always wondered, what were they doing to Han in Empire Strikes Back? What exactly was Vader doing to his daughter's boyfriend on Bespin? Doesn't seem as bad, right? But Officer Kane turns it up to 11 and we're left to wonder. I mean, here they were talking about how she was a success story.
You are a real credit to this program. It's nice to know that for every failure, there's a success like you.
This should offer him some relief.
Shall we?
Do you mind if I stay? He relapsed, but he's a friend. I still care about him.
Of course you do. Yes, you're welcome to stay.
This is what I'm wondering. Why didn't the episode just have all the Coruscant stuff only and then end here on this scene? It would have been great. She bites the biscuit and we're done. No, seriously. I mean, I think Katie O'Brien's performance was amazing. I still don't know if she's with Gideon or maybe she's just a sadist who switched sides. I think we're being shown that she's still loyal to Gideon. But that's something we're going to have to figure out. She could be punishing him for giving away information. She could be trying to undo the rehabilitation. I don't know what this mitigator thing does. I really do wonder why we don't just start and end in Coruscant, though. I can't believe that it's because they didn't want to go an episode without having Mando in his own show. But maybe, you know, maybe after hearing criticism on the Book of Boba Fett, I hope that's not why. Instead of ending there with the biscuit, though, we go to the Children of the Watch covert. Actually, we go to them coming out, you know, Bo-Katan and Din Djarin coming out of hyperspace. And this planet is not hidden. I mean, even though he was an outcast, he still knows where to find them, right?
I'm bringing you to a Mandalorian covert. This is how we have survived in exile.
I'm familiar.
It's a secret location, and you are my guest.
They still live by the old ways.
Yes. It will go smoother if you keep your helmet on. Trust me.
Of course.
By the way, looking at their approach in the N1 and the gauntlet to the cave, I'm even more confused how that gator thing snuck up on them in the first episode of the season. It's way too shallow. Now, maybe they should have just changed this shot or not shown them approaching, but I think that's a missed attention to detail. Nitpick, but it's there. I mean, it could be a different cave. Yeah, I guess. It could look almost identical, but I mean, I don't think that's it. Anyway, small nitpick, but they're met by Paz Vizsla, who's probably not too thrilled to see a Kreese show up. Credit to this Vizsla, though. He is obedient to the armor. He doesn't make trouble. Bo-Katan and Din Djarin and Grogu get their audience with the leader of the Watch. Paz presents his cleansing as a claim. The armorer asks him, is it true? Din, are you redeemed? Din says yes, and he presents the vial of living waters that he took as proof. Are they getting a litmus strip out or testing the pH balance with pool chemicals? No. She pours it into the tempering or quenching vat, and the water shimmers, just like we've seen so many times before. What's this, Bo-Katan? I thought the water wasn't magical. Maybe she just doesn't know about the forging process as a princess, but this is the thing that we see whenever the armor has made armor pieces or whatever in the past episodes. The water shimmers when the living waters are poured in. She pronounces him redeemed. Then she goes a step further. She says the same thing for Bo-Katan. This is huge. I mean, if she has a grudge against her, this doesn't happen. She is committed to this part of the Children of the Watch. This is not lip service. I think even Bo-Katan is surprised. She's an outcast for a different reason. Probably blames herself for the purge. We've heard the armor say as much in the Book of Boba Fett. Suddenly, because Bo-Katan has followed the way in just this short amount of time, she finds a new home and a new family. This is the way.
Din Djarin, you are redeemed. This is the way.
This is the way.
And Bo-Katan Kryze, by creed, you too are redeemed. But I do not walk the way. Did you bathe in the waters? I did. And have you removed your helmet since? No, I have not. Then you may join our covert and live as your ancestors once did. You may leave anytime you wish. Until then, you are one of us. Welcome, Bo-Katan of Clan Kryze. This is the way.
This is the way.
Remember what I said before about something completely unexpected happening? I mean, I did not even see this coming, even though I noticed parts about her keeping her helmet on, her looks at Din Djarin, how she seemed to be changed as a person. She wasn't going to go in until she saw someone in peril. Then she didn't hesitate. She's not more worthy for diving in, but you know what? She is worthy of redemption. Will it stick, though? Is she going to take off her helmet? Or is she going to find a way to lead the Children of the Watch to the mines and experience or witness the same miracle-born myth? I cannot wait to find out. And next week's episode, the title at least, was spoiled by Carl Weathers, the director. Chapter 20 will be called The Foundling. Weathers last directed, I think, The Siege, Chapter 12, I believe. Just like The Convert, will The Foundling refer to more than just Grogu? Let me know what you think. Interact with us in one of several ways. First and best is email at thisisawaypodcast@gmail.com. Visit our Linktree site for more ways at linktr.ee/thisistheway pod. You'll find This Is The Way Podcast on Twitter and Instagram at thisistheway pod, or on facebook.com/thisistheway pod, and we're on YouTube. Subscribe if you haven't already and like our posts and content, and please leave positive reviews. Positive words aren't just good for the soul. There's always someone who's going to ruin a rating by giving it a 1, even if it's not terrible. And the 5s have to balance those out. I wish people would just rate accurately, but the algorithms don't care. They don't take that into account. And I wish I didn't have to ask you. But I'm trying to grow this community, and that's how it's done on the internet these days. Thank you for joining me for This Is The Way Podcast's reaction and discussion of The Convert, Season 3, Episode 3, Chapter 19 of The Mandalorian. I'm your host, Steve Lascalzo, and this is The Way. May the Force be with you, always.